You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2013 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fifth class in a series given by Brother Dyron Hamlin on the subject, The Big Picture, Faith-Boosting Evidence for the Why of All Things. This class is titled, Prophetical.
Let's turn our Bibles to Isaiah chapter 41. Isaiah 41, starting at verse 21. The Lord, the King of Israel, has this to say, You gods of the nations, present your case. Bring the best arguments you have. Come here and predict what will happen, so that we will know it when it takes place. Explain to the court the events of the past and tell us what they mean. Tell us what the future holds. Then we will know that you are gods. Do something good or bring some disaster. Fill us with fear and awe. You and all you do are nothing. Those who worship you are disgusting. I have chosen a man who lives in the east. I will bring him to attack from the north. He tramples on rulers as if they were mud, like a potter trampling clay. Which of you predicted that this would happen, so that we could say that you were right? None of you said a word about it. No one heard you say a thing. I, the Lord, was the first to tell Zion the news. I sent a messenger to Jerusalem to say, Your people are coming. They are coming home. When I looked among the gods, none of them had a thing to say. Not one could answer the questions I asked. All these gods are useless. They can do nothing at all. These idols are weak and powerless. Turning over one chapter to chapter 42, I just want to read verses 8 and 9. I alone am the Lord your God. No other God may share my glory. I will not let idols share my praise. The things I predicted have now come true. Now I will tell you of new things, even before they begin to happen. The ability to tell the future is unique to Yahweh of the Bible. I think it bears our consideration. Let's look at Acts chapter 1, verse 11. We all sit here in this room purposefully applying our minds to the things that are written in the Bible, trying to deduce by our powers of human reasoning the ways of the world, past, present, and future. And I think it's probably safe to say that Acts chapter 1, verse 11, is somewhere in the back of each of our minds. Whether it was the little seed that was planted that motivated us to come here today, or whether you were brought here by somebody else that was motivated by this little seed, whether you own one of the t-shirts that has it printed on the front or not, it's printed somewhere in your minds. When these two men appear before these disciples and say, Galileans, why are you standing there looking up at the sky? This Jesus, who was taken from you into heaven, will come back in the same way that you saw him go into heaven. Probably safe to say that you, like me, have spent a lot of time pondering this event, pondering this description, wondering what it's going to look like when he returns, possibly wondering when he will return. Probably. I don't have that answer today. The evaluation of prophecy in the Bible is not a trivial subject. and it's not one that I will presume to do much deduction with. Not that I don't do that on my own time, not that I don't seek those things, but that the purpose of prophecy is what? Say it a little louder. To see the things which are coming upon the earth, to discern the times,
to instruct us in our lives today.
Purpose of prophecy, to instruct us in our lives today, to boost our faith. I really think the primary purpose of prophecy is very concisely put by Jesus when he says, I have told you these things before they come to pass, so that when they come to pass, you will believe. So actually, the purpose of prophecy is a past thing. And the ultimate purpose of prophecies is so that when the future does turn out just the way it was predicted, we'll believe. So a lot of the prophecy that we look to in the scriptures to build our faith are fulfilled prophecies. Now certainly there are some future prophecies that are sort of dangling out there for our consideration. For the men of Jesus' time, there were a lot of prophecies that were sort of dangling out there for their consideration. And I'd like to go now to 2 Peter chapter 3. I want to mention one other book that I had in my book list up there the other day while we're looking this up. It's called The Day and the Hour. And if you look at this book, what the author has done is he's compiled a list from as far back as he has researched, which is pretty far back in time. He lists the number of predictions and the dates of the predicted coming of the Messiah. And it's really interesting to see sort of the concentration of the predicted dates of the coming of the Messiah, especially as you enter the 1800s and the 1900s and see how the frequency of those predictions increases. It's nearly an exponential type of graph. Now, thankfully, there are a few that extend beyond the year 2013. So I began attending Christadelphian meeting at the age of zero, and was born in 1976. And since that time, I've seen 1987, 40 years after the establishment of the nation of Israel. Everybody said, "A generation shall not pass; all these things will be fulfilled." Come and go. That's tough to take. I've seen 1996, 4004 BC, Usher said, is when the clock of history was started. 7,000-year plan of God. I found it interesting this morning to discover that none of our teens in the class, in the teen class, had ever heard of the 7,000-year plan of God. Found that remarkable. Because that was always taught as a really big deal to me. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing necessarily. I mean, I think it's an important piece of trivia to know. I think it may not be trivial. But what I'm saying is, you know, for me, if I had put my whole stock in the 7,000-year plan of God and, you know, 4 years before the year 2000 came and went, and what would that do to my faith? That'd be tough on me. The future, and I alluded to this earlier in the week, that that's kind of the elephant in the room. You know, we're all here because we believe Acts chapter 1, verse 11, aren't we? We believe that. My grandfather is a deep student of Bible prophecy, and I heard things from him in the last few years that I wish he had never had to feel, because it's discouraging to a student of Bible prophecy to see dates come and go and to look into a future that is bleak, not because the promise is any different, but because I can no longer deduce a date. Why? Why are we abusing ourselves in this way? And I think I look at the book of Ecclesiastes, and I think that's one of the reasons I I latch onto it the way I do, as it is, again, an absolutely realistic view of life. It gives you the power to approach each day and to live fully present, which is where we belong. We belong in the present. We do things that can affect the future, and we'll go in and we'll look at the last few chapters of Ecclesiastes today. But I want to visit 2 Peter chapter 3. This is another chapter of great comfort to me. Because God understands our weaknesses. He knows that we can't deal with uncertainty. He knows that we're impatient creatures. He knows that we're easily troubled. He knows that our faith is weak. He knows that believers in the last days are going to struggle with their faith. And he writes for us 2 Peter chapter 3 as a little boost for your faith. My dear friends, this is now the second letter I have written to you. In both letters, I have tried to arouse pure thoughts in your minds by reminding you of these things. And again, you know, keep in the backs of your minds that though the whole purpose of prophecy is looking back. And Peter does this. Peter looks back. Peter calls to remembrance. Look in this entire epistle, how many times this phrase comes up. I want to call you to remembrance. I want you to remember these things. And think of Peter's life and how he remembered his time with Jesus. I mean, Peter, of all people, he needed to remember. He needed to look back to the things that the prophets had foretold. He saw Jesus in the flesh, like we ended up with on Wednesday. Blessed are those who believe in him and have not seen him. He says, I want you to remember the words that were spoken long ago by the holy prophets and the command from the Lord and Savior which was given you by your apostles. First of all, you must understand that in the last days some people will appear whose lives are controlled by their own lusts. They will make fun of you and will ask, he promised to come, didn't he? Where is he? Our fathers have already died, but everything is still the same as it was since the creation of the world. In our scientific world, we have this principle of uniformitarianism, which is that everything that you see today is the same type of process as it has always been. And that's a strong force in our modern scientific world. Science then attempts to jump into the world of predictive science and things that will happen and how the earth was created through the Big Bang, and therefore at some point there's basically two trains of thought. Either the earth is going to continue to expand into a cold bleakness, or at some point it will begin to contract upon itself and our end will be really exciting, really a lot of fun. Either way, it's going to be fun. It's either going to be really cold or it's going to be really hot. That's basically where we've come with our science. So all things, do they continue as they have from the creation of the world? Are they the same? This is a lingering question that Peter answered for us long ago. They purposefully ignore the fact that long ago God gave a command and the heavens and earth were created. The earth was formed out of water and by water. And it was also by water, the water of the flood, that the old world was destroyed. But the heavens and the earth that now exist are being preserved by the same command of God in order to be destroyed by fire. They are being kept for the day when godless people will be judged and destroyed. But do not forget one thing, my dear friends. There is no difference in the Lord's sight between one day and 1,000 years. To him, the two are the same. The Lord is not slow to do what he has promised, as some think. Instead, he is patient with you because he does not want anyone to be destroyed, but wants all to turn away from their sins. Let's look over at Matthew chapter 6. I understand that you guys have heard a great deal about the Sermon on the Mount this week. And I mentioned in the very first class that I worry. When things are going well, I worry. When things are going poorly, I worry. It's a thing I do, even though I'm told not to worry. I stress about when he's coming. I stress about why he's waiting, even though Peter tells me not to. These are questions that run through my mind every day. What is the point? Why am I even getting up today? Is he going to return? What can keep me motivated? What can keep me pushing on? In Matthew 6, 25, it says, this is why I tell you, do not be worried about the food and drink you need in order to stay alive, or about clothes for your body. After all, isn't life worth more than food? And isn't the body worth more than clothes? Look at the birds. They do not plant seeds, gather a harvest, and put it in barns. Yet your Father in heaven takes care of them. Aren't you worth much more than birds? Can any of you live a bit longer by worrying about it? And why worry about clothes? Look at how the wild flowers grow. They do not work or make clothes for themselves. But I tell you that not even King Solomon, with all his wealth, had clothes as beautiful as one of these flowers. It is God who clothes the wild grass. Grass that is here today and gone tomorrow, burned up in the oven. Won't he be all the more sure to clothe you? What little faith you have. Do not start worrying. Where will my food come from, or my drink, or my clothes? These are the things the pagans are always concerned about. Your Father in heaven knows that you need all these things. Instead, be concerned above everything else with the kingdom of God and with what he requires of you, and he will provide you with all these other things. So do not worry about tomorrow. It will have enough worries of its own. There is no need to add to the trouble each day brings. You know, science is supposed to be the study of what is, and we alluded to that in the first day about in 1 Timothy 6, verse 20, where he calls it science falsely so-called. And that is not the place of science. It is, in a lot of ways, it's our modern-day idol. It is one of our modern-day idols. And people try to have a very rationalistic view of the world, and it's not a healthy thing. We have a supreme advantage over the people of this world. The people that choose not to use the scriptures to guide their walk each day. You know, this is the last class of Manuka. And, you know, I'm thinking about this last night, and there's this point of drama as we approach the end of the week that we have been here considering the things that are most important to us all week, and it has been wonderful. And now we each have got to go into our lives, and you know, you have a job, or you have an ailing parent that you're caring for, or you have a sick child, or you are going to go back in your retirement and enjoy the rest that you have earned after your years of labor. Whatever it is, everybody has some day-to-day life thing to go back to. You know, one of the things that that they have concluded, again objectively, is that living in the present is one of the most powerful things that you can do for your health, for your mind, for your body. Living in the present. Now, what does that mean? You know, for us, that means taking the opportunity each moment to do something of value, to add some value to the world. Whatever little bit that you can. You know, that sounds like a fluffy sort of charge that we have. But when we begin looking down the road, we look into the future. We know what's coming. But that's God's territory. That's God's territory. All we really have control of is right now. And that's one of the things that Solomon points out to us. You know, the 7,000-year plan of God, maybe we were a little fuzzy on one end or the other. I can only hope. I can only hope that 2013 is still within our mathematical, statistical error. I can hope. And that's what I live with each day. I think about those two words, faith and hope. You know, faith is believing in something. Faith is what is established. It's the belief that's established through our view backwards towards prophecies fulfilled. I talked about Brother Will Jackson coming to believe because of that wonderful prophecy of Tyre and how specific it was and how temporal it was and how everything fit just right. You know, there's been other people throughout time, and I would be interested to hear anybody's thoughts as an aside on Zechariah chapter 13, where he talks about the prophets. Just, I would really be interested to hear what other people think about that, because there's going to be prophets in these last days, and I wonder who our modern prophets are. Sometimes I watch Well, I don't watch it, but I'm in the airport and I see CNN and I see Fox News and I see all these things and I think, are those our modern prophets? And then there's a piece in Zechariah 13 where he talks about how they'll remove their cloak, and I don't know if that has to do with a hairpiece or what, but I'd be interested to hear what you think about that. Our modern-day prophets, people, the pundits, the people that think that they can tell you what next week is going to be like. I love watching the weather, you know. We can't even predict the weather, right? And I know that's trivial, but the future is God's territory. It is not our territory. And he does this for a reason. He does this to humble us. I was talking with somebody recently about, and Solomon alludes to this in Ecclesiastes, about when you die. No one can tell you about the day of your death. And when you're old and people reach a point when they really would rather die, whether they're in pain, whether they're suffering, whether life is just that hopeless, they see the suffering around them. Well, God doesn't give you that option. He doesn't let you choose. And you don't know anything about it. You know nothing of your futures. And this is this theme that keeps coming up over and over again. I want to look at Luke chapter 24, verses 13 to 27. We're in good company because on that same day, two of Jesus' followers were going to a village named Emmaus. And they were talking to each other about all the things that had happened. As they talked and discussed, Jesus himself drew near and walked along with them. They saw him, but somehow did not recognize him. Jesus said to them, "What are you talking about to each other as you walk along?" They stood still with sad faces. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only visitor in Jerusalem who doesn't know the things that have been happening there these last few days?" "What things?" he asked. "The things that happened to Jesus of Nazareth," they answered. "This man was a prophet, and was considered by God and by all the people to be powerful in everything he said and did. Our chief priests and rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and he was crucified. And we had hoped that he would be the one who was going to set Israel free. Besides all that, this is now the third day since it happened. Some of the women of our group surprised us. They went at dawn to the tomb, but could not find his body. They came back saying they had seen a vision of angels, who told them that he is alive. Some of our group went to the tomb and found it exactly as the women had said, but they did not see him. Then Jesus said to them, 'How foolish you are! How slow you are to believe everything the prophets said. Was it not necessary for the Messiah to suffer these things and then to enter his glory?' And Jesus explained to them what was said about himself in all the scriptures, beginning with the books of Moses and the writings of all the prophets." So these men that had spent years with this man, Jesus, didn't understand. They had no idea what was going to happen. And I take great comfort in these verses, because what good company to find myself in, right? And we, again, on our own time, we spend all of this effort thinking, what is that going to look like when the last trump sounds and when his feet stand on the Mount of Olives and it cleaves in two? And I can make all sorts of flood geological predictions about what's going to happen, and the earth will raise up and living waters will flow forth from Jerusalem. And, you know, back in Genesis 49, it's interesting, one of the promises to Joseph is that those fountains of the great deep that are underneath the earth will be brought forth. Wouldn't that be fascinating? Wouldn't it be? Might it be? Yes, it might be. But I won't know until it happens. I have no idea. The future is God's territory. What would Solomon have to say about this? Let's look over in Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Where does this leave us? What should we do with these thoughts? And Solomon has been through sort of a broad brush view of how the earth was created and the cycles of the world that we talked about on Monday. You know, on Tuesday, he took sort of a turn and said, "Well, I can't understand that, so I'm just going to try to work on myself. That's a project big enough in and of itself." You know, he feels like, again, like John mentioned, I agree. I think he comes to some better understanding of his own flesh. And then he looks and turns to the oppression that's in the world. And he realizes that this world is and always has been full of problems and struggles to understand what he can do about it, if anything. In chapter 8, he begins to sort of dip into what I think deals with the uncertainty of the future. If you look at the different occurrences of who can tell a man what shall be after him, you see in these last five chapters quite a bit of that. So he begins to think about what his own future holds, and of course, no one can tell him. Let's look for an example down in chapter 8, verses 6 through 12. He says, "There is a right time and a right way to do everything, but we know so little." And part of the groundwork that he lays for this is that you think you're doing the right thing, you think you've been a great parent, you've raised your child just right, and you've taught him all the right things, and you took him to the right Bible schools, and you did all these things just perfect, and you don't have any control over what happens when they become a teenager. You don't have any control. I have, Ash was going to be 14 in October, although we choose not to use the word teenager. We choose to believe that he is either a boy or a man, sort of like all of the rest of us men sometimes are boys and sometimes are men. Hopefully men more often than boys. You can't tell what will be after you. And we try to control so many things. And Solomon points out that some things are not in your control. Again, all you can do is deal in the present. My dad, he's right over there. He's a smart man. He never says anything. But trust me, he's a wise man. And one of the things, you know, I'll call him with some just vast, complicated problem that you could really, it has 1,000 different angles that you could approach it, and I'll say, "What should I do?" And I'm so glad that I have a father that I can call and ask that question to. What a blessing. And I always get the right answer because he always says the same thing. He always tells me, "Do the right thing." There you go. That's what I get. So, verse 6, "There is a right time and a right way to do everything." That's true. Unfortunately, we don't always know the outcome. He says, "None of us knows what is going to happen, and there is no one to tell us. No one can keep himself from dying or put off the day of his death. That is a battle we cannot escape. We cannot cheat our way out." That's a very realistic view of life right there, isn't it? Life is going to be difficult. There's going to be tough things. Don't cheat your way out. There's always something to do. You can always do the right thing. I saw all this when I thought about the things that are done in this world, a world where some men have power and others have to suffer under them. Yes, I have seen wicked men buried and in their graves. But on the way back from the cemetery, people praise them in the very city where they did their evil. It is useless. Why do people commit crimes so readily? Because crime is not punished quickly enough. A sinner may commit 100 crimes and still live. Oh, yes, I know what they say. If you obey God, everything will be all right. But it will not go well for the wicked. Their life is like a shadow, and they will die young. Doesn't always happen, does it? That doesn't always happen. The sinner keeps on living, and the righteous person dies a painful death in their youth. That happens. That happens sometimes, even for believers. We are all subject under this curse. And if we realistically appreciate that, I think we save ourselves some mental suffering at least. You know, it's kind of the opposite of what we read in 2 Peter 3, right? In 2 Peter 3, God tells us that he's waiting. I think of it like a farmer who waits for the last bit of the fruit or the crop to come ripe before he sends in the harvest, right? Before he reaps the crop, he waits for the last little bit to come ripe. So if we're suffering a little longer, the reason we're suffering a little longer is because somebody is going to turn their life around. That's the way I think of 2 Peter 3. He's not slow concerning his promise. He's long-suffering towards us. Unfortunately, at the same time, and we must assume that in a smaller proportion, the wicked get to keep on sinning. I'm hoping that the proportions are, you know, more people are turning than are continuing to sin. But how many is enough? You know, we have the example of the 99 and the 1, and so on. chapter 9 of Ecclesiastes, in verse 1, this thought process, this sort of journey that Solomon takes us through in Ecclesiastes, I think starts to take kind of a turn where he brings forth some wisdom that is actually very encouraging. He says, I thought long and hard about all this and saw that God controls the actions of wise and righteous men, even their love and their hate. No one knows anything about what lies ahead of him. The righteous and their works are in the hand of God. This goes back to what we said, you know, from the very beginning, is that you either believe that we are an insignificant pale blue dot in the middle of a vast expanding universe, or you think that God actually cares about you. Either way, you believe something. You believe that God cares about you, that he wants you to be stones, not bricks, and that he has his eye very closely on this world. When he created the heavens and the earth and he hovered over the face of the deep, if I may draw from something I learned from Brother John, a beautiful picture of that word hovering is the same word for cradling in your arms like a father cradles his son. And that's the extent to which God cares for this planet and for us, his creation. That's what I believe. Some people believe we're a pale blue dot. I don't believe that. I believe that the righteous and their works are in the hands of God. I believe that there is purpose. I believe that the future, that the prophecies, the simple prophecy of Jesus' return, where he explicitly says, you won't know the day or the hour, you're not going to know, and hence the title of that book, The Day and the Hour, and hence we have all of these predictions of different dates that he will return. We don't know. It's fun to think about. Honestly, I didn't prepare any classes this week because December 20, 2012, wasn't that supposed to be it, right? You watch the movie, the earthquakes, the volcano didn't erupt. December 21 came out, I was like, what is going on? We can't be sure. Chapter 9, verses 10 through 12, work hard at whatever you do. Because there will be no action, no thought, no knowledge, no wisdom in the world of the dead, and that is where you are going. Again, sort of a very positive thought, a very powerful thought, one that should spur you to action, that's couched in a very negative thought. And that's real. That's real. You know, when we leave here, yes, Bible school is over. It's going to be over. What's next? What's tomorrow hold? Some travel. You're going to meet some people on the plane. You're going to see a toll booth operator. What are you going to do? How are you going to respond? In that moment, you're going to do the right thing? You know, somebody attacks you. Somebody talks poorly of you. How are we going to respond? In that present moment. He says, I realized another thing, that in this world fast runners do not always win the races, and the brave do not always win the battles. Wise men do not always earn a living. Intelligent men do not always get rich. I believe that. And capable men do not always rise to high positions. Bad luck happens to everyone. You know, in this world, you will have trouble. Be of good cheer. He has overcome the world. It's not in our own power. Towards the end of the chapter, he talks about this story that seems important, that relates to a wise man delivering a city, a poor wise man in a city that delivers it, somebody that in the present said, I have an idea. I have a way that I can end some suffering in the present. Wonderful things to latch on to and do. In chapter 10 and 11, you know, I think he sort of reflects on the fact that, yes, you can't predict everything, but you can talk in terms of risk and reward. You know, it's likely that if you don't get up and repair your roof, that eventually it's going to fall in. Neglected things don't fix themselves. Work doesn't do itself. Donations don't make themselves. Somebody else is not always going to take care of it. And in regards to rewards, let's look over at chapter 11. And start in verse 1, and I want to read through chapter 12 and verse 8. I want to lump these things all together because God does have a reward intended for his people. And these two chapters bring very closely the idea of living in the present. And I hopefully the younger you are, the more you will listen. Invest your money in foreign trade, and one of these days you will make a profit. Cast your bread upon the waters, right? Foreign trade, you'll make a profit. Again, risk reward, probably so. You might lose it all, but likelihood is invest your money. He actually, in the next, he says, put your investments in several places, many places even, because you never know what kind of bad luck you're going to have in this world. Diversify your portfolio. What a nice practical piece of advice that lots of people pay financial advisors lots of money to tell them. No matter which direction a tree falls, it will lie where it fell. When the clouds are full, it rains. I love that verse, by the way. The tree falls to the north or to the south, where it lies, that's where it is. That's where it is. It's just a very pragmatic view of life. And when it falls, and it's starting to fall in the northerly direction, he's saying, I can tell you about that far into the future. Yep, that one's gonna point north. I think that's what he's saying. If you wait until the wind and the weather are just right, you will never plant anything and never harvest anything. God made everything, and you can no more understand what he does than you understand how new life begins in the womb of a pregnant woman. We're trying scientifically to understand that, and we're still not very good at it. It's, you know, Psalm 139. Think about that. Read that. Be encouraged by that. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. Do your planting in the morning and in the evening too. You never know whether it will all grow well or whether one planting will do better than the other. It is good to be able to enjoy the pleasant light of day. Be grateful for every year you live. No matter how long you live, remember that you will be dead much longer. Beautiful, beautiful passage. We listen to A Prairie Home Companion is a radio show. I'm not, again, it's completely secular, not endorsing it, but we enjoy it for entertainment. And he says something one time about going out and traveling to different places and seeing things and doing all these things and creating these memories, he says, because you'll be lying there in the ground and you'll be dead and you'll need things to think about. Now, obviously, we just read in chapter 9, that's not the case. You won't be thinking about anything, but you will be sleeping and waiting a better day. But be grateful for every year you live. And you know, some of this sounds so sort of positive psychology, fluffy language, but I think that's why he builds us such a beautiful base of negativity, or what we think of as being negative, in the first part of this book. Because he says, look, if you have a realistic view of life, you get to do this stuff too. Be grateful for every year you live. Young people, I think they're up there. The light is kind of blinding. I'm pretty young too, so I'll just speak to myself. Enjoy your youth. Be happy while you are still young. Do what you want to do and follow your heart's desire. But remember that God is going to judge you for whatever you do. Again, there are constraints, people. Constraints. Don't let anything worry you or cause you pain. You aren't going to be young very long. I heard a lot of that's for sure's up in this part of the room. Whew! You wake up with those thoughts in your mind and it changes your approach to the day, I think. So, remember your Creator while you are still young. You know, it's interesting that Solomon refers to God as your Creator in this passage too. And it does reflect us back to the purpose, doesn't it? The purpose that he has for you and for me and for this earth. Before those dismal days and years come when you will say, I don't enjoy life, this is when the light of the sun, the moon, and the stars will grow dim for you and the rain clouds will never pass away. Then your arms that have protected you will tremble and your legs, now strong, will grow weak. Your teeth will be too few to chew your food, and your eyes too dim to see clearly. Your ears will be deaf to the noise of the street. You will barely be able to hear the mill as it grinds or music as it plays, but, and this is the cruel irony of hearing as we grow older, but even the song of a bird will wake you from sleep. We can't hear the things we want to, and we unfortunately hear the things that sometimes we don't want to. You will be afraid of high places. It's funny. I find Mari and I are already starting to sort of be more careful where we step. And I don't hop from rock to rock like I used to. I'm a little more cautious. Your hair will turn white. You will hardly be able to drag yourself along. And all desire will be gone. We are going to our final resting place. And then there will be mourning in the streets. The silver chain will snap. And the golden lamp will fall and break. The rope at the well will break, and the water jar will be shattered. Our bodies will return to the dust of the earth, and the breath of life will go back to God who gave it to us. Useless, useless, said the preacher. It is all useless. I like that this is the end of his useless. This is the last time he mentions useless. And then he gives us these wonderful words to conclude the book. Because the preacher was wise, he kept on teaching the people what he knew. What a sense of despair to go from that despair and then to actually do something useful. He studied Proverbs and honestly tested their truth. The philosopher tried to find comforting words, but the words he wrote were honest. The purpose of life is not to tell people necessarily that everything is going to be okay for them right then. Sometimes, again, there's a time for sorrow and there's a time for happiness. The words he wrote were honest, an absolutely realistic view of life. The sayings of wise men are like the sharp sticks that shepherds use to guide sheep, and collected proverbs are as lasting as firmly driven nails. They have been given by God, the one shepherd of us all. Son, there's something else to watch out for. There's no end to the writing of books, and too much study will wear you out. This is true. You know, and I've said a lot of words this week, and I'm always humbled to say a lot of words because I don't feel frequently very worthy to say words because I'm no rocket surgeon. You know, I'm not anything. I'm nothing. I'm a worm and no man. I think, you know, anybody that would tell you differently, you know, it's a humbling thing. It's a humbling thing to consider these things. And it, when he says, you should be careful not many of you to be teachers because you will receive a greater judgment, I'm really quite nervous, actually. It's kind of a curse to be asked to teach. But I believed, and therefore I have spoken. I believed, and therefore I have spoken. You believe, and therefore should also speak. Every day, set it in your minds, I determined to know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Wear it every day. It ends at Manuka. No, it's tomorrow in the airplane. It's the next day, back at your meetings, or it's the whole year until we come back again. That's what it is. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. It's very simple. Like I said, many words, 5 days worth of words that really are summed up in one verse. And I could have just read that verse in the beginning, and we could have all just visited. Maybe that would have been better. Hopefully I've given you some things to think about, and in your many words and conversations, You can enjoy those visits. God is going to judge everything we do, whether good or bad, even things done in secret. Now I want to close with Acts chapter 17. Because everybody worships a God. Everybody worships something. And anybody that says that they don't, and that they've got life all figured out, and et cetera, is setting themselves up for something. And the men of Athens were very superstitious and had many gods, and they had so many gods, we're told, that they had a tomb to an unknown god because they just wanted to make sure they didn't miss anybody. And this is really, I think, a good corollary for our world today. So much seeking. So many people need to know the meaning of life, and nobody's really digging into it in the right way. Acts 17, starting at 16. While Paul was waiting in Athens for Silas and Timothy, he was greatly upset when he noticed how full of idols the city was. So he held discussions in the synagogue with the Jews and with the Gentiles who worshiped God, and also in the public square every day with the people who happened to come by. Certain Epicurean and Stoic teachers also debated with him. Some of them asked, "What is this ignorant show-off trying to say?" Others answered, "He seems to be talking about foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching about Jesus and the resurrection. So they took Paul, brought him before the city council, the Areopagus, and said, "We'd like to know what this new teaching is that you're talking about. Some of the things we hear you say sound strange to us, and we would like to know what they mean." For all the citizens of Athens and the foreigners who lived there liked to spend all their time telling and hearing the latest new thing. Paul stood up in front of the city council and said, "I see." He stood up in front of the city council and said, "I see that in every way you Athenians are very religious. For as I walked through your city and looked at the places where you worship, I found an altar on which is written, 'To an unknown God.' That which you worship then, even though you do not know it, is what I now proclaim to you. God, who made the world and everything in it, is Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in man-made temples, nor does he need anything that we can supply by working for him, since it is he himself who gives life and breath and everything else to everyone. From one man, he created all races of mankind and made them live throughout the whole earth. He himself fixed beforehand the exact times and the limits of the places where they would live. He did this so that they would look for him and perhaps find him as they felt around for him. Yet God is actually not far from any one of us. As someone has said, 'In him we live and move and exist.' It is as some of your poets have said, 'We too are his children.' Since we are God's children, we should not suppose that his nature is anything like an image of gold or silver or stone shaped by the art and skill of man. God has overlooked the times when people did not know him, but now he commands all of them everywhere to turn away from their evil ways, for he has fixed a day in which he will judge the whole world with justice by means of a man he has chosen. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising this man from death." When they heard Paul speak about a raising from death, some of them made fun of him. But others said, "We want to hear you speak again about this." And so Paul left the meeting. Some men joined him and believed, among whom was Dionysius, a member of the council. There was also a woman named Damaris and some other people. He has appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by means of the man he has chosen. That's why we're here. That's what motivates our waking, not just at Manuka, but in our lives. There is a future that we know generally of. And I'll end by saying my grandfather said, "I don't know when he's going to return, but I know that he will."